this is the last of the three talks, and frankly, I would rather have had somebody like Ray Jackson or Sherwood or Susan or Penner give this presentation, but they were unable. So this is my perspective. I joined the U.S. Water Conservation Lab in 2004, so it really was after a lot of the pioneering work. So I'm just trying to put the pieces together and understand what you guys did and why it matters today. Because all you do is look at the literature and you just see these names appear again and again. And so what's the impact 50 some years later? And so some of these pictures are from those old days that you see in the bottom. You can see the old water lab. It was pretty bare bones. That's its logo, water saved is water earned. They were flying with a NASA aircraft, which I hadn't mentioned was one of the accomplishments of the water lab, was to bring in other federal agencies such as NASA. And you might say this was low-hanging fruit, but they decided to come here. They decided to do the experiments here because the expertise was here, and that's that shows. So the early work that Rob mentioned was the soil and water physics that was going on. And all you have to do is look at some of these old pictures to see what a challenge it was to conduct these experiments. I mean, computers were around, but they were primitive and expensive. Laboratory equipment was not terribly sophisticated in some of the respects, but very expensive. They had to invent their own soil compacting columns in order to get uniform bulk density measurements, an important observation, important measurement for consistent scientific data. They didn't know how to measure soil moisture accurately. Obviously, neutron probes have been around since, I think, at least the 50s. There were other techniques such as gamma ray soil moisture measurement, beta ray measurements. I don't hear about them nowadays, but they had to be tested, and these guys tested it, and it's all written up in the literature. And of course, it was a lot of shovel work. Some of the early work with net radiometers was done here in Maricopa and Phoenix. The so-called friction net radiometers. Well, net radiometers had been around for a while, but they suffered from serious thermal drift. And that was a problem that had to be investigated and tested in the fields. Well, the U.S. Water Conservation Lab had lysimeters that they could look at the full soil water balance. Those lysimeters weren't available in most places, in fact, maybe nowhere else were they available. And so these diagrams illustrate some of the prototypes. I mean, they're looking at very fine details, such as why was there bias in long wave and short wave radiation, and they painted little white stripes on the net radiometers and so on to do compensation. And then one of the scientists, I believe it was Sherwood, said, well, stop painting that ridiculous little white stripe there, because in fact there are other errors that are much larger. All these things had to be tested in the laboratory, and they did it. Now on the right hand side there is what they call, I shouldn't laugh, but they said this is their portable weather station. It only takes 5 kilowatts to run this station, and it had taken to any station with a pickup truck and trailer. So we laugh today about the portability of weather stations, but this is what they had to work with, and they accomplished the science in that context. Infrared thermometry. I mean, I think it's because I look back there, and it's almost a cliche. It's like saguaro cactus, and if you want to have your picture taken, you have to be holding a thermal infrared instrument. So I started collecting them, and you can see our previous our first speaker here. You see Sherwood over here. I'm not sure who that is. And I think that's Jerry Hatfield, and this is Rick Roeke. So what's the big deal about thermal infrared radiometers? Well, Bruce back can probably say what the problem is. The original ones, to my understanding, were around $60,000. I mean, it's $60,000, 1965 dollars, not 2016. Very expensive, and no recording. So if you wanted to record it, you'd have to take a tape recorder out in the field, or you'd have to write it down on a piece of paper. And then you couldn't just take it out of the field, you had to warm it up for 15 minutes. The Water Conservation Lab did all that because they knew the benefit for that would be that we could do crop water stress and maybe do irrigation scheduling with this and also monitor soil moisture. Of course, today it all seems so easy. They're portable, they certainly don't cost $60,000, and they're very accurate. Well, just a few slides here to show you about what I see is the evolution of that, but it's already been described. I mean, I think it was maybe accurate to say that it was Jackson Itso that came up with the stress degree concept in the mid-70s. And the idea was very simple, was to look at the air temperature canopy temperature difference. And they started collecting data, and that's illustrated here on durum wheat on the left-hand side, and comparing the evolution of those temperature differences over time for a different water stress. And what they noticed was that the end of the head growth for wheat followed a nice linear trend. And that's shown there by the green line. On the right-hand side, they plotted cumulative degree days, and they compared that against wheat yield, and they found it was pretty insensitive to when the wheat was actually planted, which is a very significant thing here in their results. Of course, it's a relatively small set. So they had already crop water stress index. It was called stress degree day. Well, then later studies showed that it was affected by surface moisture, humidity in the canopy, in the crop canopy. So then they weren't perturbed. They went ahead and developed something that was sensitive to vapor pressure deficit, which Rob mentioned in his talk. And so what these three figures from their paper show is that under non-water stress conditions, that the air temperature humidity for those crops follows a nice linear trend. And then when it becomes stressed, it follows a trajectory oblique to that trend line up to a baseline. And then when they compared that against soil moisture observations, they found that it was a nice correlation between neutron probe measurements and the crop water stress index, so a very nice agreement. It was done empirically, and it was also further developed by Ray Jackson on a theoretical Penman-Monteith basis. But even so, then people wrote papers and said, well, this isn't working very well either, because it doesn't work if you have incomplete cover. How do you handle that? So then Susan Moran, Tom Clark, and others wrote a follow-up paper where they used vegetation indices to combine the crop best aspects of crop water stress indices into this trapezoidal pattern that you see here. And the result there is that they show that index accommodates some of the variability in canopy cover and temperatures. Is it the final answer? Surely not. There are some limitations to crop water stress index and the water deficit index. But this just shows you the spirit and the accomplishments of the U.S. Water Conservation Lab is to keep revising, accepting where results are not as expected and where they need to be improved. That led to a more remote sensing phase in the Water Conservation Lab, as mentioned in previous talks. Here are illustrated some NASA aircraft that flew over the old Water Conservation Lab. And I believe they're using film, not CCDs for these recordings where they did the visible near-infrared. Much more expensive and laborious, but valuable data for early space programs. On the right-hand side is Rob's results showing the variability and evapotranspiration that can be computed with measuring temperature. And it was also during these studies where they realized that incomplete canopy cover was an obstacle that had to be solved. They didn't resolve it then, but they realized that that would be a shortcoming that had to be solved if you were going to use thermal infrared for energy balance. I'm not sure that a lot of people appreciate that the current FAO 56 model, where you do crop coefficient driven by vegetation disease, originated from an offhand remark by Ray Jackson in a proceedings paper out of, not sure, Idaho or somewhere. He just says, well, you know what, it might be possible. There's a definite correspondence between vegetation indices and crop coefficients, except for the early season where there's not much growing. So it's just sort of an offhand remark, and I believe that led to Walter Bausch and Christopher Neal's paper on developing a relationship between vegetation disease and crop coefficients. And FAO 56 is very widely known, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that a lot of that idea originated out of the water lab research. Another aspect that originated out of the lab studies was to show you that everybody pulls out NDVI maybe a little bit too strongly, and work by Penn and others shows you that there's tremendous variability with these magical indices that have to be accounted for, in this case based on row structure. And to this day, I have to say that I still see papers that seem to have not looked at the 1970 literature, and should. Big Mag experiments. Again, I wasn't here for this. I believe there were 5 experiments. These were multi-institutional experiments that occurred with no exchange of funds, I believe. Everybody had to be self-financed. You just had to agree to share your data, and that was the spirit of the water lab that Rob brought up. As you could come here, you would coordinate with other field activities, you'd have laser scanning, you would have aircraft flights, you'd have soil moisture, eddy covariance, all these. These led to some major papers, some of which are documented in Route Sensing and Environment. And they also highlighted the need for daily updates and the need to measure thermal infrared in early afternoon. And these 2 facts I pull out because it's astonishing in 2016 I still find that NASA is asking these questions. Well, do we really need to have daily observations? And when do we best observe temperatures for crop water stress? And I'm saying, well, these guys in 1975 made these observations based on experiments. Do you think you should look at those? So I think we're a little guilty of not looking at the literature. Lastly, this is not biophysical measurements and sensors item, but I had to include it because the Water Conservation Lab was much more than just measurements, or much more than sensors. This is one example. John Replogle is at our water lab. He designed with others broad-crested weirs that are used all around the world. I mean, this is the kind of institution that fostered development, invention, and promulgation of very useful engineering designs. So what's the legacy of the water lab? I certainly can't summarize it in the short talk here, but the theme of the session was measurements were once slow and awkward, and they're now much faster. Almost 50 years of work, they worked on sensor design, they calibrated them, they worked about compensation for environmental effects. They looked at the environmental parameters that can be incorporated in remote sensing. They evaluated evaporative transpiration at both local and regional scales, and now applicable to studies around the world. And they're very concerned about how to use remote sensing for water and farm management. So what's the vision? I mean, this is, I'm putting words in the water lab's mind that maybe never existed. But I think that they were thinking these things, that they needed sensors that were accurate, calibrated, low cost. They had to be robust and generally applicable around the world. They also realized that measurements couldn't do the job themselves, but they needed to be integrated with models. The integration of models with observations, absolutely essential. And lastly, I think that they would say the daily observations are essential for water and farm managers. Having observations every 2 weeks isn't enough, and that's an elusive goal. Ray Jackson had put together a paper about a plane that could be in the stratosphere flying 24 hours a day, and that idea is still timely. I mean, it seems a little far-fetched, but the observation was very good. If you're going to help farmers manage their water, you need to give them daily information. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.